Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, no fingerprint scanner in the iPhone 8. AMD is gaining on Intel. The Threadripper 1900X is for real. The Core i7 6700K is no more. And we got a tiny GTX 1080, if you can find it. All that more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 431, recorded September 7th, 2017. It's as if 50,000 Vegas cried out in terror.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again with Eero's hyper-fast, super simple Wi-Fi system. And now, the second generation Eero is tri-band and twice as fast. For free overnight shipping, visit Eero.com, select overnight shipping at checkout, and enter code Twitch. And by iFixit, the free online repair manual for everything. Before you start your next build or fix, head over to iFixit.com/twit to snag the fully loaded ProTech toolkit for only $59.95. And check out their array of high-quality parts, tools, and guides.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and this week, oh boy, the most OLED mobile news available in the entire hardware universe. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrout. How are you, sir?
I am doing well, actually. No complaints here on this side, I guess. I was complaining before the show that it was disappointing that my daughter gets to take naps every day, and that's generally accepted by society. But I'm not allowed to do that. So, you know, there's that.
One of the most talented copy editors ever worked with took a nap every day from 2 o'clock until 2:30. He made it abundantly clear that that was part of his process, and he took names and kicked ass and took naps. And, you know, I think you could take names, kick ass, and take naps should you choose to make that a part of your lifestyle.
30 minutes is like one of those odd spans of time for a nap where, in my experience, there's only two outcomes of a 30-minute nap. One, I wake up refreshed and ready to go. Two, I wake up just angry at everybody. And you know, you gotta work through that. I don't want that kind of variability in my life. I'll just, the consistency of being tired I can deal with, and I've gone, you know, let's say 20 something years of figuring out how to work around. So I guess I'm good where I'm at.
I am all about the 20-minute, like, drink a cup of coffee, power nap for 20 minutes, and wake up happy.
All right.
You should try it.
Worth a shot.
Threadripper 1900X makes it official today. Technically, today was right after we recorded our last podcast. I mean, almost literally. What we're talking about here is the 1900X, which is the low-cost version of the Threadripper, the $549 part. Should you be avoiding AMD Threadripper news, the 1950X is the 16-core, 32-part that sells for $1,000. The 1920X is a $800 part that has 12 cores and 24 threads. And the Threadripper 1900X is the 8-core, 16-thread version, sells for $549. Not particularly, you know, unexpected. I mean, there's half the cash on the 1900X. Has anybody been running performance benchmarks on this yet?
No, so they did not send out review samples of this. You know, they claim that was a result of everybody being inundated with Threadripper, Ryzen, Vega 64, Vega 56 testing, and that they just kind of wanted to let it go, which is sure fine. I have seen no reviews of it. I've seen no benchmarks of it. There's some interesting qualities that it has that would make it an interesting discussion from a performance standpoint. One, it has the same number of cores and threads as the Ryzen 7 1800X. And even though the MSRP price is only listed as a $50 delta in price, in reality, the Ryzen 7 1800X has been selling very consistently for like $430, $440. Right. So you're looking at more like a $100 price difference between it and the 1900X. So that's going to paint the picture a little bit differently, I think. Also keep in mind that the platforms that you can buy for that process are going to be very different prices as well. The lowest price Threadripper motherboard you're going to find is like $340 or so. So it makes your total investment somewhere around $900 to get the processor and the motherboard just by itself. Whereas you can get a Ryzen 7 1800X compatible board, like a B350, for around $100, $110. So significant difference there. Now, what's interesting,
doesn't sound painful at all.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Or way less so. From an architectural standpoint, there are interesting data points, right? Like the TDP difference is twice as much, even though you have the same number of cores. That's the possibility of two things. One is, you know, they're kind of picking the dies in such a way that they're a little bit less efficient. So they're inside that envelope, which is what they've rated the whole platform for. Thus, they can use more dies, you know, and increasing their yield that way. And even though the dies are only going to have four cores on them each, just because of the distribution. Or the other alternative is like, this is going to have a lot of overclocking headroom. Now, even with that possibility being there, in general, we have seen no real consistent overclocking of Ryzen processors over, you know, 4.2 gigahertz or something like that. So I don't think we're going to see anything like magically pop out with the 1900X in regard to that type of stuff. You do have quad channel memory instead of two channel memory, which means your memory bandwidth will go up. But because you're jumping between physical die as you move between four cores to four cores, you're going to have a little bit added memory latency on average as well. So applications that are more latency dependent will probably regress in performance a little bit. Applications that are more memory bandwidth dependent will increase in performance as you jump between those two parts. And then the other big difference right there is those PCIe lanes on the back, the 64 versus the 24. So if you're a potential benefit to something like the 1900X, it is the lowest entry point, lowest price entry point to getting this massive amount of connectivity in your system, right? So if you know you want multiple PCIe SSDs, multiple graphics cards, 10 gigabit Ethernet, that type of stuff, but you don't really need a whole lot of compute capability for whatever reason, right? Whatever your workload happens to be, you don't need a lot of CPU compute. Then the Threadripper 1900X gives you that entry point. It's maybe still not as inexpensive as I would like to see, but nobody else really even comes close to offering it, right? Because even the 8-core Skylake X part, which does exist, is 24 lanes of PCI Express, 28 lanes maybe, but it's way lower than that and more in line with like the standard Ryzen 7 parts. So, you know, they've created an interesting part that's going to have a slightly different performance profile than any other part that they have created thus far. And I mean, that's kind of what you want. You want to have something to address for everybody. But I'm curious. I'm still waiting to see if I can convince them to send me one, or if I'm going to have to buy one to see how it really stacks up against things, because it's the way the cores are configured is going to determine a lot about the performance of the product in real world applications and testing.
At the risk of sounding cynical, I might suggest, and before I get cynical, I want to say I do love the incredibly simple naming strategy that AMD chose for the Ryzen processors, you know, where you go from the AMD Ryzen 7 1800X to the AMD Ryzen Threadripper 1900X. It's just easy. It's bigger, therefore it's better, right? But I think that what you're saying is, you know, there is a possibility that the low-end parts weren't sent out from the Threadripper series because for a lot of consumer uses, the delta in performance may not be particularly awesome compared to the AMD Ryzen 7 1800X. That's totally
very true. I would expect that in the 1080p gaming scenarios or even 25x14 gaming scenarios where Threadripper was worse than Ryzen, this Threadripper will be more worse than Ryzen, right? Again, just because of the way the architecture is broken up. This is why I'm a writer, everybody. Worse.
I can tell you have words. Speaking of words, you wrote up a little spiel for the crew over at MarketWatch that went up earlier today when we were recording on September 7th. AMD gaining ground on Intel faster than analysts had thought. So this is particularly interesting, right? Because you took a look at numbers from Germany's Mind Factory, which is kind of odd in the PC industry or the consumer facing side of it, in that they make their sales data public. What did you see outside of a whole lot of AMD processors flying out the door? Or was it really a whole lot of AMD processors?
It's not so much about the individual quantity. So this is one of the bigger direct like retail and online resellers in Europe. I think it's definitely the biggest in Germany, but it's one of the bigger in Europe as well. And it's not so much about the raw quantity as it is the ratio. This is publicly accessible data that was just compiled by a couple of different people. And what you'll see is there's two sets of bars there, left and right, for each month: March, April, May, June through August. The left side is the AMD share. The right side is the Intel share. So it starts out in March. This is after the Ryzen 7 release, right? It's up to 27.4%. It was probably down to like 20 or 15% before that. And what you'll see is a general increase all the way up to the right, where in the month of August, they actually exceeded Intel's unit share sales, 56% to, 42% or 44% or so. Just kind of marking this probably being the first time in near a decade or almost a decade that AMD processors outsold Intel processors at this particular retailer and e-tailer, mm-hmm. right? You can look at a couple of other interesting things, right? They've broken it down per processor as well, and although it's hard to read because there's a lot of different options there in the legend, the light solid green is the R5 Ryzen 5 1600. It's a 6-core. It's like a $220, $230 processor. It's a significant portion. It's the most popular part they offer. But what's also kind of neat is that if you look around that, you look at the 1600X, you look at the 1700X, like they're selling a diverse portfolio of parts. Whereas if you look at the Intel side, that deep purple of the 7700K is clearly the dominant player in that, with the 7600K being the only other one that really has like a standout sales record, I guess, if you will. So it would appear that by having a diverse portfolio of processors that appeal to different customers based on their price point, that they're benefiting from that in some degree as well. And then the second graph is basically shows the same story, but it's in terms of revenue instead of unit sales. Similar story, similar percentages. The only thing that kind of noteworthy there is that the deep red at the top of the AMD for August represents the Ryzen, well, what they call the R9, otherwise known as the Threadripper 1950X. It's a fairly significant portion of that, considering the units are much lower, but because it is a $1,000 processor. Right. That's not too bad. And you compare that to the revenue that the Core i9-7900 made, 7900X, which is the very top marker on the Intel bar, and you'll see that they sold more Threadrippers than they were selling Skylake X. And both of these launched in approximately the same type of time frame. Skylake X came out the month before. The general takeaway from this is not that AMD is outselling Intel across the board in all these different markets and at Amazon or Newegg or whatever. And all of my indications from talking to other people is like in North America, the Amazon Newegg sales, the Intel Core i7 i5 still have the advantage in terms of units sold, but AMD is continuing to chase them in that regard. But Threadripper versus Skylake X, Threadripper is outselling Skylake X in pretty much every location I've been able to talk to somebody that will answer me. So it's not that the results from this one German place that happens to publish their sales data publicly, which is amazing for us who are trying to keep track of this stuff, but it's by far the oddball out there, is that AMD is making these inroads. They're clearly having an impact in the channel sales of these processors, and that's really what they wanted to do. Now the questions are, what is Intel's response? Is Coffee Lake going to change that around? What is AMD's reaction going to be to these changes that Intel is making? I think it'll be really interesting to see how that all pans out as we jump into, is it fall now? Are we out of summer? I think we are, right? We're technically in fall now. So as the fall progresses, how all that shifts around. But it's just interesting to see that data from one spot where AMD kind of slowly went up this ladder and is doing much better in the CPU world than you can say in recent past. So,
well, one thought, good for them. The other thought, I think it'll be interesting to see how this story plays out as we head into the holiday shopping season, as Intel ramps up its competition at the high end, and to see if, you know, if this was pent up demand or people that were inspired by the performance story on the AMD Ryzen processors, or if this is a major shift in desktop processor sales over time. So I'm excited, you know.
Yeah.
I'm also running an AMD Ryzen 7 1800X right now. And
there you go.
It did a huge, it runs things more, better, faster for less money, which is pretty compelling when you're buying at the high end. Oh my goodness. No more buffering. No more dead zones. Wi-Fi that works. Doesn't it sound nice, people? This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Eero. With Eero, you can install an enterprise-grade Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. Simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it'll walk you through each step of the process. Quick, easy, and painless. You can easily create and share a guest network, know how many devices are connected at any given point, and check the internet speed you are getting from your service provider. Eero is protected with state-of-the-art WPA2 encryption. Eero updates automatically, so you'll have the latest features and security at all times. Now, they're excited to introduce the second-generation Eero and Eero Beacon. The Eero home Wi-Fi system started in early 2016. Since then, they've learned from hundreds of thousands of systems, making them smarter, faster, and more reliable. The new Eero second-generation and Eero Beacon allow a customer to build a Wi-Fi system that's more perfectly tailored to their home than ever before. They plug into the wall now, the Beacons. Super convenient. With the addition of a third 5 gigahertz radio, the second-generation Eero is now tri-band, and Eero says twice as fast as its predecessor, which lets customers do more simultaneously in every room of their home. And with the addition of a new Thread radio, Eero can connect to low-power devices such as locks, doorbells, other sensors, and more. You can add as many Eero beacons as you want. If there's an outlet, there's Wi-Fi. And I got to say, if you've had issues in your house, it is amazing to see what mesh networking can do for you. For free overnight shipping to the U.S. or Canada, visit Eero.com and at checkout, select overnight shipping, then enter Twitch to make it free. That's Eero.com and enter the code TWICH. We want to thank Eero for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. iPhone 8 rumors are piling up hot and heavy as we, hit Apple Day.
Getting close. 5 days.
Yeah. 5 days. And it's funny because Apple's keynote, September 12, 2017, 10 a.m., first event from the Steve Jobs Theater and the fabulous new app, what I assume is the fabulous new Apple spaceship down on the peninsula. Much like the Samsung phone, the Note 8, we're looking at a price around $100,000, around $1,000. just to toss it, $100,000, but they'll replace it every year for the next 3 years. I'm kidding. What I'm not kidding about is when we have the imminent launch of an iPhone, right? There's the rumors start piling up and the rumors start getting hot and heavy. Then they all kind of settle into a groove, which is in this case punctuated by places that usually aren't leading the rumors, leading them, which is the Wall Street Journal. And the article that came out today in the Journal basically says there's not going to be a fingerprint scanner in the iPhone 8. There's not going to be a home button in the iPhone 8. The conjecture is that you're going to have to type in an old-fashioned password, or it might be face unlocking. But apparently they couldn't get the fingerprint scanner under the OLED screen tech to work. And in the process of trying to get the technology to work out, they delayed production by about a month this summer. And apparently, so Samsung's been creating an integrated display and touch panel, and Apple wanted a separate display and touch panel to be basically glued and duct taped together. I exaggerate slightly there about the duct tape. And it's also interesting that a Samsung subsidiary is actually producing that OLED screen for the iPhone. But essentially, they couldn't get the button to work or the not button to work. And they are pressing forward. They're going to launch the LED models and the OLED models on the 22nd, or at least open up the orders. Again, conjecture. It was crazy to realize KGI, Ming-Chi Ko says the iPhone's 8 Samsung-made OLED display costs $120 to $130 per unit. That's compared to $45 to $55 for the LED screens in the current iPhones, which is a huge jump when you're looking at the cost of parts. And that Apple's apparently freaking out because they have a single supplier of iPhone 8 OLEDs. And the thing I've heard over and over again is part of the advantage of producing in China isn't necessarily labor costs anymore, but the fact that you have this huge gathering of parts suppliers and manufacturers and this very, very quick ability to turn over or create or iterate or just deliver things. So, to have a single source supplier for something as critical as the screen that is the centerpiece of your 10th generation or your 10th anniversary iPhone 8 is probably a pretty intense thing for the crew at Apple to be dealing with right now. So, plus Samsung, Apple, and the battles over the last few years. I mean, that's just got to hurt to be cutting those checks over there.
Sure.
The other thing I thought was kind of funny this week is Apple's iPhone event is taking place at the same time Mobile World Congress. They're basically the first time they're doing a Mobile World Congress in the Americas here in San Francisco on September 12th. So right about the time Mobile World Congress is launching, Apple's doing its event at the Steve Jobs Theater. So it's going to be interesting.
It's almost right? like they do this on purpose, you know?
It's the craziest thing. You know, I wouldn't think they would do that, but I could be wrong.
I have a lot of potential concerns about the idea of getting rid of Touch ID for an entire, collection of people that have become very used to it. I mean, the facial recognition stuff must work really, really well if they're willing to give up Touch ID, right?
I'm going to say something. Just stop for a second. Remember the Maps launch on the iPhone?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, there are things that Apple does because Apple is totally on it and getting to do exactly what they want to do. This, if they were trying to get it work through this summer and lost a month, I hope the facial recognition stuff is amazing. And some of the camera technology they're working with has the potential to make it amazing.
Sure.
But the other side effect of this is that there are questions about between the lost month of production, and the volatility of the potential OLED supply, that it may be really difficult to buy one of these in Q4 this year. It's go ahead. Sorry.
No, I don't know. It seems so odd to me. I was having a Twitter discussion with somebody who was talking about these OLED shortages and issues. And I kind of questioned, they said, there's a shortage. That's why there's going to be so hard to find and why there was a delay. And I was like, yeah, but the truth is like Apple in the past, when they want to create a new technology, they just go out and enable these suppliers. And so they don't have these kinds of shortages. They're usually the company that organizes the ecosystem around them so that they don't have to worry about having problems of, we have one supplier for this. Oh yeah, well now we've enabled this guy. Now we have two suppliers. Now they're competing. Now we have plenty of inventory. So I would be curious. I would love to know the background of why this didn't work out that way, why they weren't able to enable, if OLED is your bottleneck and you're going to use OLED, build another OLED factory with somebody and have it ramp up on time, have it ramp up at the time you want. Obviously, things happen, but Apple's is usually the epitome of like business structure perfection, right?
Right.
And it doesn't, all the stuff coming out with this new phone shows that not to be the case. So it's just very off for me.
It's off, and I think it's probably a little frustrating. And of course, again, this is all based on rumors, but sure, we've also traditionally had rumors have gotten sort of, centralized isn't the right word for it, but traditionally, as you've gotten closer to the launches, there seem to be collections of rumors from sources that might possibly have gotten leaks from Apple, leaks in the official sense of the word. And we've heard talk about this going back earlier this year. You know, it's sort of the part of the seeding, I think, back in July. It was like, all right, it's going to be about facial recognition. You know, it's facial recognition. We've got a 3D camera that can scan your face in a millionth of a second. There's, you know, the HomePod smart speaker software, where it was basically like the face detect stuff was leaked in there, where right. It looks like they're, you know, using infrared capture in the biometric kit that's in the HomePod. Well, basically the HomePod people, as they're digging through the HomePod software, found stuff that recognize or references to the face detect methods in the biometric kit. You know, it's going to be interesting because there's been pretty consistent rumors for the last couple of months that, boy, this has been a tough one and supply may be constrained. But the other thing you could say is that, boy, Apple could totally be planting those rumors so people frantically try to order first, you know, much like consoles selling out on the first day. Like, we didn't build it. You know, the demand is so strong it overwhelmed the number of consoles we could build. And it's like, right. Yeah, tell me another story.
I would even posit that if Apple is kind of like, you know, letting this information out a little bit earlier, it's less so that people want to hurry up and order and more so that they don't have to tell the story as to why there is a shortage or why they're right. more expensive or something like that. Right. This is how we're going to have this wart on our product launch. How do we help buffet that some? Right. And the answer is, well, let's start seeding that information out earlier so people have time to digest and accept that, oh, it's not Apple's fault. It's OLED production. Oh, it's not really Apple's fault. It's that Samsung couldn't get the display and the fingerprint reader to work together or something like that. And, you know, they don't have to get up there and kind of explain that quite as much. Don't get me wrong. They're still going to be asked plenty of questions about it, especially right. if you sell, you know, if I don't forget what it was a month ago where they talked about maybe they're able to produce 4 million of these phones this year. And you think, wow, that's a lot of phones, except that they usually ship 70 to 80 phones a quarter or something like that. So if that's the case, there's going to be way more people willing to spend $1,200 on a phone than they have phones to sell. So let's see how that pre-order process goes. Let's see how the technology looks. And if, you know, it's hard to ever, like, you can't say it, like, Apple's not going to have a flop on their hands. They're still going to sell whatever they make, more than likely.
A metric ton.
Yeah. I will probably be one of those idiots trying to wait for the 7 a.m. pre-order time because I want to see this tech and try it out for myself. But, you know.
Refresh.
Right. Refresh. I remember I was lamenting about how painful the iPhone 7 purchase process was as I tried to use the app on my phone versus the app, you know, the website on the computer. And one I had in the thing and I didn't know if the order went through and all that type of stuff. And it's just, you know, it's just going to be that, you know, maybe taking up another step or another level of magnitude if shortages are that severe. I don't know.
I will say that given that OLED or AMOLED technology is essentially thinner than a TFT LCD, I'm hoping that Apple has decided to put some additional thickness into the structure of the case for the iPhone 8. Just saying.
Hey, I'm with you. I don't think so, but I'm with you. Bigger battery, too. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
I like slightly that. Thicker and more battery. Two things that Apple will not do almost assuredly.
But we can dream. Speaking of Apple and Samsung and screens, I have been known to replace broken phone screens, and I have been known to go to iFixit.com. To do so, to get the tools. I love the crew at iFixit. They are dedicated to making all the technology in your life more accessible, either by creating the amazing tutorials that walk you through repairs on your electronics. As a matter of fact, they're doing amazing tutorials and repairing everything in your life, which brings me to the fact that this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. If you're familiar with iFixit, you know they really like to take stuff apart, teach people how to fix things. You know, the Galaxy S8, iPhones, the Switch, they're doing teardowns, doing repair videos. They're leading the charge in electronic repairs tools with their iconic black and blue ProTech toolkit. I have one of these. My wife has one of these. My children have one of these. There's one of these in the office. There's one of these in my truck. I like the ProTech toolkit. If you go to the store at iFixit.com, They explain how each piece of the kit was meticulously designed. You're not going to find a higher quality toolkit like this on the market. And don't let the sleek design fool you. This toolkit's got both beauty and brawn with high quality steel bits and tools tough enough to handle any repair or mod you throw at them. And I assure you, I've done some terrible, terrible things to the toolkit, and it has survived. It's only $60, $59.95. The tool roll makes it compact and easy to store. The included 64-bit driver kit is awesome. It pretty much has all the bits you'll need for just about any DIY electronics repair. The case is really cool, right? It's a big plastic case, keeps your bits organized. You open it up, flip it over, the bits won't fall out. The bit kit, there's a magnetic mat under it that holds the bit kit in place. You can pull the bit kit out and basically put little tiny screws onto that magnetic space there to keep them from disappearing. Really nice swivel top magnetic precision driver, a flexible extension for those hard to reach screws like the motherboard screws that are kind of hidden by the edge of the case that you can't get the screwdriver into. You can do that with a flex extension. Plastic opening tools, spudgers, picks, a suction cup with a delightful fancy handle that makes it easier to remove display assemblies. The rubber handled Jimmy pry tool. I fixed that. I actually designed the Jimmy pry tool. It is a pretty slick way to get inside of a case without permanently destroying it or sawing your own hand off because you were misusing a sharp knife. Best part, iFixit tools backed by iFixit's lifetime warranty. You don't need to buy something to get iFixit's free repair resources. They give them away for nothing. You can check out over 25,000 free repair guides over at iFixit.com. You want to tackle your next hack, fix, or build with a ProTech toolkit? Visit iFixit.com/twit to snag the fully loaded ProTech toolkit for only $59.95. Thanks, iFixit, not just for sponsoring this week in computer hardware, but for making it easier for all of us to repair our gear. It's good stuff. iFixit.com/twit. Oh, my goodness. Core i7-6700. Let me try that without the stuttering.
Almost got it.
Core i7-6700K and Core i5-6600K finally see end of life by Intel. This saddens me because I have a 6700K in my primary desktop at home.
I bet a lot of people do. Yeah.
And it's like 2 years old. And now
it came out in August of 2015 is when these processors launched. The question came up on our podcast last night about, is this a shorter or longer than expected time period based on like historical norms for this type of EOL? And I honestly don't know the answer to that. I will say it feels like it's sooner, but I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. There is a date in there labeled 3017 instead of 2017. And I imagine that's a typo and not a 1,000-year window for reorders. But essentially, so even though this basically September 5th marked the beginning of the EOL, the end of life process, but you'll still be able to place orders up through March 30th, and then they will be delivered up to September 7th of next year. So you still have a little time if you need to buy an extra for replacement process or something like that, Patrick. You're totally able to do that. And you look at that table of timeframes, right? It's interesting and, you know, mind-numbing to think about how a company that produces these parts and then makes promises about how long they're going to be available, how long they will be around for enterprise or consumers or businesses or embedded applications. And, you know, they make all these assertions when they put these launch parts out. And then they have to manage all that on the back end, right? And, you know, from a logistics standpoint, it'd be way easier to have way fewer processors in flight at any given time, right? So this is the beginning of the end for Skylake for the consumer line. There's a whole other host of processors that are on this list, like the Core i3-6098P, which I had never heard of and don't really know what its use case is. But that's probably one of those embedded parts. It may be in, you know, cellular network gear or something like that. You know, it could be any number of stuff. The reason I thought this was interesting is, you know, the focus for Intel is going to be on the Kaby Lake selling parts, the Core i7-7700K, 7600K, and also, we already have been told about, you know, we know about the upcoming 8th generation parts, right? The Coffee Lake parts. They're going to come out for this same segment of user, new motherboards, all that type of stuff to go along with it. It also, the last couple of sentences I wrote on this post kind of came to me as I was writing. It marks the end of an interesting window of time for Intel, where it had clear and uncontested dominance of the consumer processor market. Rereading my conclusion to that review that came out in August of 2015 reveals almost no mention of a relevant AMD competing part, making today's situation with Ryzen and Threadripper all the more impressive. And I do find that to be an interesting, just kind of like flag marker in the timeline of PC hardware, in that, you know, when Skylake came out, Ryzen wasn't really on the mindset of people. We didn't know when it was going to come out. We didn't have any expectations of performance. We didn't hear any claims about 43% improved IPC. It was just, I remember, like, I reread that last page, and it was all about, like, well, is this better enough than the last Intel part to warrant you to upgrade? Right? Those were the types of conversations we were having. Right. And with Kaby Lake, when it came out, different story, right? Now it had competition in different areas. It was what was out now, what was known to be coming out, all that type of stuff was still filtering through. So kind of marks the end of an era of self-competition for Intel, I guess. So there's no data point to take from that other than I found it really compelling and interesting to kind of digest.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, we spent a lot of time talking about the fact that, like, boy, this is nice. There's a 10% performance improvement on the desktop and you know, acknowledging at first kind of covertly and then kind of overtly getting acknowledgement from Intel that, like, that's nice. We understand you like more desktop performance, but we're really about TDP and battery life on laptops, which, given the bulk of their markets there, they just seem to get less and less enthusiastic about people who have to do really serious work on a desktop and have not been able to do that on a laptop. So, I agree, end of an era, and I am delighted that AMD is forcing Intel to probably pay much more attention than they particularly want to the desktop market again. So I'm excited. It's going to be a good Q4 if you're building desktops, I think. Although, you know, we still don't have any information on the 8th generation Intel processors because they pretty much refuse to talk about it. I don't anticipate much information being out before October, right? Because, you know, September, mid-September is when the laptops are actually going to hit the street with the 8th generation Kaby Lake, 7th and a half plus generation Kaby Lake laptop CPUs. I think we beat that to death a couple weeks ago, so I won't get into it again. But I'm very, very curious to see what the parts are, what the 8th generation parts are, what the ship dates are going to be, and what the prices are looking like going into Q4. I'm hoping it's going to be a great holiday shopping season, whether you're building or buying a desktop or a laptop. If nothing else, way more cores inside of laptops come September. My goodness. Intel Skylake X 18 core die pictured. It's as if the engineers at Intel saw the Threadripper and was like, yeah, hold my beer.
One of the interesting things that we know about, say, Intel's workstation class parts is that there's three die. They made three different monolithic dies, meaning all the cores are on one die. Remember, Threadripper is two physical die, and Epic is four physical die, all operating at the same time. With Skylake X, it is one socket, the new, the LGA 2066 socket, but there are two dies for it, right? There's the up to 10 core die. So there's the 6, 8, and 10 core die, which looks like the picture below that, actually, where what you notice is, what you kind of see is you see the die, and then you see the substrate around it. And then if you look, there's another substrate around it. There's another package around it, right?
Right.
And you look at the picture at the top, that is the higher core count die that goes up to 18. So the 12, 14, 16, and 18 core processors will have a physical die that looks like this. You see the same design, right? There is, it looks like a processor on top of a processor. And that is basically how you get one socket and one platform to match up with multiple die, right? Mm-hmm. And then not featured in Skylake X, but will be featured in those business card size processors that we showed, you know, a couple of months back with the Xeon Scalable launch, is a physical die that is up to 28 cores, and it's going to be even, you know, more enormous, right? I think, you know, that 18 core die that you're looking at there, the big one on that page, is around 450 millimeters squared, which is a little bit bigger than like a GP102. It's a little bit smaller than GP102 GPU. So, but you're in like high end GPU range with that. And then the larger one, the 28 core die, is actually close to 600 millimeters squared. So again, now you're getting into like reticule size for that. So it shows there's nothing. The only kind of new information we got from this, and this is from one of the high profile overclockers right now, Der Bauer. He's got an 8 in his name. I don't know exactly how to pronounce it here. But that he got one of these early and delidded it and showed this processor. They're still not using solder, right, between the die and the heat spreader, which is going to disappoint some people, but it should be expected at this point because Intel has been so consistent on that. They're just using a normal thermal interface material between them, which is going to give you less, lower thermal performance. But, you know, again, Intel has been very consistent in this. They haven't been like changing their tune. But still, it's kind of neat to see the innards of this, right, where you only normally see the heat spreader of it itself, and get a little idea of what the design process was like. It literally looks like a processor on top of a processor. I mean, there's even like, if you look at that picture in the bottom left-hand corner, there's two arrows, right, that self-point to each other that would then line up with a socket, right? So, I wonder if there was at one point there was a socket that was just for the small one, and that was maybe an idea they had. I don't know. It's just kind of neat to think of that it could have existed that way. Or maybe if you look at this is an interesting question. If you look at something like the new iMac Pros that are going to come out that have up to 18 core processors in them, will they maybe be soldered on and use the smaller package? I don't know if that's the case. I literally have no clue. I don't know if that's already been determined or whatnot, if people have been able to take apart any of those early production models or something, but I could see it happening that way as well.
You and me both. I might have to sell some blood and get the 300-watt HDPlex upgrade from S4 Mini ITX case, because Gigabyte has figured out how to stuff a GTX 1080 in an incredibly tiny space. Or as Jeremy Hellstrom wrote on PCPro.com, the cutest little GTX 1080 you'll see. Gigabyte's GTX 1080 Mini ITX 8G, 17 centimeters long, dual slot design. It's crazy, 90 millimeter fan. And basically it's running in gaming mode at the 1733, 1607 megahertz boost and base clock speeds. Overclocking mode will raise those up to 1771 megahertz on the boost mode, and there are none available. I think we'll see what happens in terms of stock availability as the summer moves forward, and the Ethereum mining either continues to be more profitable or less profitable. But yeah, I've been meaning to get, like, we've seen a whole bunch of 1060 and 1070s in these tiny configurations, and I've been like, oh, I can finally upgrade my nines. I guess I went from a 750 Ti to a 960, but the 750 Ti. In any case, it's exciting if you're into tiny cases to see this much graphics performance crammed into that small of a space. I'm excited. Whether or not I can actually handle the power demands of it in my little tiny case is another question. We will find out. Card availability is just going to continue to be kind of a suck. To use highly technical economic terms.
You're not wrong. I continue to, on a daily basis, kind of track, okay, what Vega cards are available, what GTX 1080s, 1070s are selling for. I have yet to find a Vega 64 selling for less than $689. I have yet to find a Vega 56 selling for less than $550. That's $150 over the $399 MSRP. And I will say that the GTX 1080s, at least, not so much the 1070s, but the 1080s have been in stock more often than not and within $20 or $30 of MSRP, and then not in stock at all. Like, I think yesterday when I checked the GTX 1080s, they were pretty much not in stock.
Right. And we're not just talking about the mini cards.
No, yes, correct. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, because I'm looking at this, and it's like, oh, okay, here's a 1060 mini IT. Oh, it's the 3 gigabyte version. Oh, that's a right. full size version. But it's we're looking at $330 for a 1060. No. Yeah, $330 for a 1060 board, a 6 gigabyte 1060 board, which seems steeper than it should be. $289, $217 for the 3 gigabyte version. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, because you get into this weird area where the custom cards were always a little bit more expensive right. than the reference cards on the NVIDIA side, but now you got to judge how much. But for AMD, there's none of that confusion, right? There are reference cards. Right. That's all that exists today. There are no partner cards available yet. So we know what the prices are expected to be for these parts. There was a news story that came out last week. I don't know if we talked about it on the show, that somebody had figured out how to get a little bit more mining performance out of Vega cards, like going from up to like 45 mega hashes per second, but also while doing it at a much lower power consumption, improving efficiency, which is interesting technologically, but bad for people who want to buy cards for gaming, right? Because now it means that the door is open. People are starting to see these efficiency gains kind of optimized for Vega, for coin mining, and availability will suffer because of it, right? So that's not, I honestly expected this to be kind of done by now, but it's not. And we'll see, we'll check back next week. That's about all I can say at this point. So unless suddenly 50,000 Vega cards drop on the reseller market, I don't know what else to do.
50,000 Vega cards cried out in horror. Yeah, no, I mean, like, Ethereum's up 35% in the last, it's been up as far as 35%. It's crazy looking at the mining prices over the last few months. Here's a quick thought before we go. If you're looking, if you're in that sort of, I want something a little faster, but I'm not going to buy a 1070 or a 1080. When you look at a GTX 1060, I would brazenly assume you would want the 6 gigabyte card rather than the 3 gigabyte. Or for 1080p gaming, will the 3 gigabyte be enough?
I actually think for 1080p, the 3 gig is probably enough. Most of the time there will be an edge cases, but also there are shader, like, it's not just memory difference. There's actually CUDA core difference between the 6 gig and the 3 gig variant there as well to keep in mind. And also in theory, the 3 gigabyte version of that card will be less attractive to mining groups. I think at least that was the case for 4 and 8 gig, like RX 400 and 500 series cards. So I'd assume that would still carry over here. So you may be able to find a closer to expected price offering or GTX 1060 3 gig too.
So the big one would be for me though, now I'm hearing like fewer CUDA cores are bad.
True.
Okay. Oh my goodness. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are just about out of time. So I want to mention, I'm testing a couple of active noise canceling earbuds, including one more's new dual driver ANC Lightning in-ear. And I'm testing that versus the Bose 220i, which is kind of the king of the hill for wired noise canceling earbuds. So if you have thoughts or questions, do me a favor, tweet at Patrick Norton. And that review will be coming up on Tech Thing in the next week or two. And we'll talk about it here. PCPer.com is a place to find Mr. Ryan Schrouts. Do you have anything you can tease that's coming up outside of the frantic joy at the launch of the Apple event next week?
We will have a story up on NVIDIA Whisper Mode probably tomorrow that looks at the advantages that software technology offers for noisy gaming laptops and at the expense of what in your frame rate and experience that actually happens to be. And then as he pokes around the office, I got in like a whole bunch of new Logitech stuff, those new keyboards and mice, as well as MX Sound speakers. that I'm looking forward to playing around with and then sending to Sebastian for a proper audio diagnostics on. So
exciting, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
PCPer.com is the website to find Mr. Shrout. You can find me at TechThing or over at AVXL. I'm actually going to be down at Cedia tomorrow, down in San Diego, taking a look at all the new shiny screens and speakers coming from a bunch of different manufacturers. So I'll probably be gushing, probably not eloquent, but enthusiastic about that next week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us here on This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find more of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/TWICH. That's twit.tv/Twitch. And in case you didn't know, we're a hardware show. We come out weekly, and Ryan and I host it. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
See you next week on Twitch.